From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The woman who became known on TV as the French chef is the American cook Julia Child. On today's Fresh Air, Child tells us how she learned classic French cooking in Paris, then returned home to teach it to the rest of us. Also, we meet film director Gus Van Sant. His new movie, Drugstore Cowboy, is about the hard work of staying high. It stars Matt Dillon as a junkie who supports his habit by robbing pharmacies. Rock historian Ed Ward remembers some of the pianists who were on the scene before Jerry Lee Lewis made it big. And book critic John Leonard reviews a collection of essays by Israeli journalist Amos Oz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Pentagon said today the Navy has decided to limit aircraft flights and warship movements for 48 hours to study safety procedures after a recent series of accidents around the world. There have been 7 accidents involving U.S. warships since October 11th. The latest came today. 13 sailors and shipyard workers were injured in Norfolk, Virginia, in a fire aboard a helicopter landing ship. Chris Dickin of member station WHRO has details.
Unlike other events and the rash of mishaps that have befallen the Navy in recent weeks, this one took place on a ship that was out of service and in dry dock on the Norfolk waterfront. The USS Incheon, an assault ship designed to hold 2,000 Marines and a supporting helicopter force, was undergoing routine maintenance in a commercial shipyard. It's believed that the fire started in an area where power lines were attached to the ship from shore. 20 military and 9 civilian workers were sent to area hospitals. Most were treated for smoke inhalation, and only 2 are known to be in serious or guarded condition. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Dickin in Norfolk.
Czechoslovakia's communist leader said today Czechoslovak citizens will no longer need exit permits to travel west. President Bush today welcomed the decision. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports from the White House.
President Bush said as he looks at changes taking place, it seems that Europe is moving in the direction of becoming whole and free. The president called the move by the Czech leader an encouraging first step.
People of Czechoslovakia have the same aspirations for freedom that others have, and I would expect we'd see further changes there, just as we have seen in Poland, Hungary, and in the German Democratic Republic.
When asked if he thought changes were coming so fast, instability might result, Bush replied that he didn't think things are moving too fast. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
East Germany's new premier, Hans Modrow, opened coalition talks today with the 4 non-communist parties only 24 hours after being elected. But 3 parties went into the talks for the first time, demanding that the communists give up their monopoly power. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa said today that his native Poland needs massive Western investment to continue making progress in democratic reforms. Wałęsa told a convention of AFL-CIO in Washington that he was grateful to the labor group for proving to be Solidarity's most steadfast ally in the trade union struggle for human freedom. Wałęsa plans to address a joint session of Congress tomorrow. This afternoon, the Senate overwhelmingly approved a 3-year, $738 million aid package to help Poland and Hungary move toward a market economy. Asked if President Bush favors the figure arrived at in the bipartisan compromise, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said, "We're generally supportive." On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 16 points to close the day at 2610.25. This is NPR News. Left-wing rebels in El Salvador today claimed control of portions of 8 of El Salvador's 14 provinces and declared they would intensify efforts to seize the entire country. Government aircraft rocketed and strafed rebel positions on the northern and eastern perimeters of San Salvador, and thousands of residents fled the battle zones. At least 500 people have been killed and more than 1,000 wounded across El Salvador since the guerrillas launched their offensive Saturday night. President Bush criticized the Salvadoran rebels for inflicting what he called senseless violence on the Salvadoran people. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president appeared before the ministers from the Organization of American States this afternoon at the State Department and gave a pep speech on the advances of democracy in this hemisphere. He had harsh words for the recent military offensive by the Salvadoran rebels, and he blamed Nicaragua and Cuba for supplying weapons to the insurgents.
I just think that we need to, if we're Democrats here, we ought to be supporting this concept of stopping the weapons going in there.
Before the meeting, the president said he would take up the issue of arms deliveries with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in their meeting next month. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The House today approved a foreign aid bill that offers up to $85 million for El Salvador's besieged military, but also contains a number of other demands for cash that could make the legislative promise impossible to keep. A key House subcommittee today approved legislation that gives the Securities and Exchange Commission broad new powers to stop Wall Street trading in times of highly volatile or unruly markets. The bill is the first legislative step toward reform of the stock market in the aftermath of the October 1987 crash and the smaller recent aftershock that buffeted investors in October of this year. It is designed in part to deal with computer-based program trading that has been singled out by critics as one of the main sources of volatility in the market. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. With the 1961 book Mastering the Art of French Cooking, Julia Child helped introduce Americans to classic French cuisine. In 1963, she started her long-running TV series, The French Chef, and became one of America's most celebrated cooks. Child's seventh book, The Way to Cook, has just been published. She addresses herself to the new generation of cooks who haven't grown up in the old traditions and need a basic knowledge of food so they can enjoy good home cooking. I asked Julia Child to elaborate on the first sentence of her new book. She writes, "Attitudes about food have changed since the 1960s when my first book came out."
Well, they've changed enormously. In the 1960s, you could eat anything you wanted, and of course people were smoking cigarettes and all kinds of things, and there was no talk about fat and anything like that. And butter and cream were rife. Those were lovely days for gastronomy, I must say. And then along came, in those days too, it was classical French cooking, and you didn't deviate from the rules. But now, and then shortly after that, we got, in the 1970s, we got Nouvelle Cuisine, in which a lot of the old rules were kicked over. And then we had Cuisine Minceur, which people mixed up with Nouvelle Cuisine, but was actually fancy diet cooking. Then we went into the organic phase, where we had bean sprouts and tofu to a large extent. And now we're in a kind of a fright situation where people are very much afraid of fats and oils, and cholesterol has reared its ugly head.
Are you afraid of cholesterol?
I think cholesterol has become such a trendy word now. Then I think a lot of people really don't know what it's all about, but they just know that they're afraid and they're eating oat bran and getting diarrhea, or some people are. So I hope we're going to get out of the silly season and get back into some good sense, because you're supposed to have a certain amount of fat. 25 to 30% of your calories should be fat or oil, because you need to process your vitamins, and if you don't have enough fat, they won't do you any good.
Well, have you cut down, though, on the desserts and sauces?
Well, I have always tried to eat sensibly, mm-hmm. and I think it's the good word is moderation in all things and a little bit of everything. And I would be a Mrs. Six by Six if I ate all that I like, so that I've been pretty sensible and I've been watching my weight, mainly for cosmetic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I have all our main recipes are mostly very low in fat and calories, and then you can add what you want. But it's written for mature people who know what they're doing. And as most people say nowadays, that you, for one thing, inheritance is terribly important. You should know what your family background is.
I'm interested about the foods that you grew up eating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you grew up in Pasadena, California.
I did indeed, and I grew up in the teens and the 20s when most people had, middle-class people had maids or had someone to help. And we had very sensible New England-type food because my mother came from New England. Of, you know, roasts and vegetables and fresh peas and mashed potatoes. But nobody discussed food a great deal because it just wasn't done. and there was no wine served at the table, at least not in my family, who were very conservative. We always ate very well, but it wasn't talked about.
Well, your family had a cook. Did your mother cook at all, and did you learn to cook at all?
No, she really didn't cook at all. She knew how to make baking powder biscuits and Welch rabbit, and that's all she knew how to make. And I didn't do any cooking then, not at all.
Did you have any interest in cooking?
I was always very hungry, but I never did any cooking at all. And it wasn't until I went over to China in World War II. I was with the OSS, and I just adored that Chinese food. It was so delicious. We were in Kunming and Chongqing. And then I met, there were a lot of sophisticated world travelers whom I met, and food was discussed a great deal. And then after the war, when I married and settled down in Washington, D.C., I began to cook and found that I've enjoyed it immensely.
Mm-hmm.
It always took me a very long time. I had Gourmet magazine and The Joy of Cooking. And then we found ourselves in France, and I can remember my first meal there. We had come over on the boat, because that was in 1948, and airplane traffic was not rampant, or it hardly existed. And we had our big old blue Buick on the boat and drove from Le Havre to Rouen. And I remember my first French meal. It was just delicious. Of course, we had wine, which I had not known much about, and oysters on the half shell, and then a beautiful dish of sole and white wine sauce with mushrooms, and I just couldn't get over. I hadn't ever had that kind of food.
Sounds very good. Before we continue about life in France, I want to just back up a little bit and go back to your childhood for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You're over 6 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you were a very tall girl.
I'm the smallest in my family.
Oh, no. were you very athletic, and did you...
Oh, very, uh-huh. Yes. I played tennis and golf and all kinds of things. I was very, very athletic, because one was in California anyway, because you could do outdoor activities.
Were you comfortable with your height, or were you self-conscious about it?
Well, I didn't like dancing school when I was much taller than the boys, but I don't know. I got used to it perfectly easily.
Mm-hmm. Julia Child is my guest, and she has a new cookbook called The Way to Cook. When you graduated from college, you went to New York with the hopes of becoming a novelist or of writing for a magazine.
Or writing for The New Yorker, or at least getting into Time or Newsweek. Nobody wanted me for some strange reason.
Why did you want to write, and were you sure that you wanted to have a career?
Well, I was. I thought I was romantic about the idea of writing or being on the stage. In those days, too, everyone was fascinated with the theater. But I wanted to do one or the other. And then I got a job at W&J Sloan's furniture store in advertising and publicity, which I enjoyed very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then along came the war, and I got into the... I went down to Washington and eventually got into the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS.
Did you want to be a spy?
I did want to be a spy, and I thought I'd be a very good one, because no one would think that someone as tall as I would possibly be a spy. But, of course, I ended up doing office, menial office work. I was in the files the whole time, which I actually, though, it was fascinating as an organization to be in, and at least I knew everything that was going on.
Did you feel that you were discriminated against because you were a woman, and that's why you were doing
work? No, see, those were in the days before Women's Lib, and women were not expected to do anything but eventually marry and have children and be good wives. I don't know exactly why we went to college, if that's all we were supposed to do. But just nobody thought of having a career, except a few people who were doctors, but I don't think there were very, very few people who ever went into law, because you wouldn't get anywhere as a woman.
Well, you were telling us how being in the OSS led you overseas. You lived for a while in China. I think you lived for a while in India.
Yep. It was Ceylon and China.
Mm-hmm. And then after the war, you're telling us you went to Washington, then went back to Paris, went to Paris and lived there. This was in the late 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
So you had wonderful food in Paris.
It was just marvelous. It was still the old classical cuisine. It was just delicious. I've never had such good food again as we had then.
Well, how did eating wonderful food lead you to want to start preparing wonderful food?
Well, I was very much impressed with the food, and I just had, having started in cooking after we got married, I decided I would go to the Cordon Bleu, and they had kind of a classes for what we call fluffies. What it did at that same time, they were having some classes for the GIs on the Bill of Rights, and I decided after doing a little bit that I would really like to do much more serious delving into cuisine so that I was able to join the GIs. And they didn't object, luckily. And we started in at 7 in the morning and finished at around 11. And then I would rush home and prepare a fancy lunch for my husband, Paul. In those days, too, the American Embassy followed the two-hour lunch, French lunch hour, so we always came home for lunch. But in those days, too, middle-class women were not going into cooking, either the French or the Americans. And the French, of course, all had maids. It was the way we had lived before the war in the USA.
So the other students were mostly chefs?
So no people that I knew, either French or American, were at all interested in the mechanics of cooking. But then at some party through a mutual friend, I met my colleague Simon Beck, Simka, who was, as I was, tremendously interested in cooking, but she knew a great deal about it. She'd worked with old Henri Pellepas and so forth. And eventually, because we began working together, eventually we started a little cooking school called L'École des Trois Gourmands. And Simka and her friend Louisette were writing a book on French cooking for Americans, and they needed a collaborator. So that's how eventually Volume 1 of Mastering came into being.
Mastering the Art of French
Mastering
Cooking.
Mastering the Art of French Cooking, you know.
Well, I want to talk with you more, but first we have to take a short break. Then we'll be back, and my guest is Julia Child. She has a new cookbook, which is called The Way to Cook. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Julia Child, when you co-wrote Mastering the Art of French Cooking, did you see it as a way to introduce Americans to French cuisine?
Yes, I was tremendously interested in French cuisine because it's the only cuisine that has the real rules on how to cook. And I had started in quite late. I was about in my early 30s when I started cooking. And I found that the recipes in all the books I had were really not adequate. They didn't tell you enough. And I won't do anything unless I'm told why I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that we needed fuller explanations so that if you followed one of those recipes, it should turn out exactly right. And that's why the recipes are very long, but they have full detail. And my feeling is that once you know everything and have digested it, then it becomes part of you.
When you moved back to the States and you wanted to continue French cooking, were there ingredients that you couldn't find in the States?
No, there were some differences. I think the cream was not as thick, but that was easy enough to make your own what they called crème fraîche by adding a little buttermilk or yogurt to heavy cream and making it thick. And in those days, cream was very chic. Nowadays, people are afraid of it. But the flour is different, but you could, because the French, general French flour is softer. and more made for pastries. And you can perfectly well duplicate that by using part unbleached all-purpose flour with a little bit of plain bleached cake flour added to it, which softens the gluten content. And, of course, the meat cuts are different, but there were otherwise I didn't find anything too difficult or impossible to do.
What do you think the American attitude was toward French cooking when your book, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, came out?
Well, at that point, when Mastering the Art came out, French cooking was very much in vogue because we had the J.F. Kennedys in the White House and they had their wonderful French chef. And at the same time, people were beginning to be able to get easily over to Europe because air flights were available. Before, you had to go by boat and it just took so long that only the upper classes could go over there, or people on extended vacations. So suddenly, Europe became available and Americans were able to go over there and taste the food, and it became very chic and people were very much interested in it.
You became nationally famous in the United States for your cooking show. I read that your cooking show started because you were a guest on someone else's show when your book Mastering the Art of French Cooking mm-hmm. came out, and there was such a big response that they gave you your own show. At that time
when they did a book review, and I had to do something. You can't just talk about it. So I beat up some egg whites in a big copper bowl, that kind of thing that people have not seen before, and I made an omelet. And at that time, there were no cooking shows at all on television. And people said, well, why don't we have a cooking show? And so I did three pilots, and they got a lot of response because there weren't any on at that point, and French cooking was very much in vogue. So they said, let's try 13 shows and see how it goes. And at that time, also, public television was mostly talking heads. And they wanted to have something that was a little more lively. And it started in Boston, and then I think Pittsburgh was the first to pick it up, and then San Francisco, and finally New York. And so that's how it really started in.
Julia Child is my guest. Were your early shows live?
No, nothing was live, but the early shows, because we were very, very, very strict budget, it was really live on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we started in, we didn't stop at all, unless there was a terrible disaster, and we only had about two or three, I think.
Tell me one of the terrible disasters.
Well, one time I was blanching some broccoli, and it was in a salad basket, which was lowered into a big kettle, and when I picked it up, my fork slipped and it all fell on the floor. I didn't pick it up and use it, so we did we did stop because it was a real mess. But every time we stopped, it would cost, several hundred dollars because it always took half an hour to get back again, and you'd have to pay overtime. And another time there was a short circuit on my microphone, and every time I touched the stove, the microphone would go and I'd clutch my breast. So we had to stop for that. But otherwise, we just didn't stop at all. And then people would say, well, I saw you drop that chicken on the floor, which, of course, I never did. All I did was flip a potato pancake into the stove, and then I put it back into the pan, and I said, well, if you're all alone in the kitchen, nobody will know. It's funny that people saw me do that to a chicken. Isn't that funny how people will say that?
So were there often mistakes in the actual show that you would recover from, thinking that, well,
yes,
this kind of thing happens all the time to real cooks?
And I think some people would accuse me of doing things purposely, but anyone who's been in the kitchen knows that awful things happen all the time, and you just, if you're a cook, you have to make do with whatever happens.
An example of something that you made do with on the air?
Well, I think that potato pancake was about it.
Okay.
But then not much terrible happened. But, I was just cooking as one normally would at home, which I think people rather enjoyed because it was informal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the way most people cook at home anyway.
I'm sure you must have seen the Dan Aykroyd Saturday Night Live.
Oh yes, we have a tape of that. That's great fun.
What he'd always do is when he was doing you is take little nips of wine until he got really giddy while he was cooking.
I know, and then people accuse me of that too, which of course I know Frank Pryle of the New York Times said that he saw me pick up a bottle and drink out of it, which of course I would never do in public. But I think his book didn't sell very well, so I don't care. No, I would never. I mean, would be a very gauche thing to do in public, wouldn't it?
Julia Child is my guest. She has a new cookbook, and it's called The Way to Cook. I want to ask you what you think of Nouvelle Cuisine.
Nouvelle Cuisine is through, I think. I think it has been very useful in that it released people from a straitjacket. Then we've gone into silly seasons and so forth. But one thing that was very useful is of paying attention to how the food looks on the plate to make it really attractive. Then I think that gets exaggerated, so something looks like a Japanese flower garden and the food looks fingered, which is not attractive. I think food should look like food, but it should be very appetizingly arranged.
When you say food looks fingered, what do you mean?
I mean, so you'd take in your thumb and sort of wet your thumb and put these little things all around the plate in the shape of petals and so forth. And I don't find that attractive because you know that they have been probably licking their fingers and putting it on the plate.
It was French cooking that got you started
mm-hmm.
as a cook. How much of your time is devoted now to French cuisine?
That's kind of hard to say because what is important about French cuisine is the techniques because they are the techniques of good cooking. It's hard to say when you say French cuisine what that means anymore. It used to mean the school of Escoffier in classical French cooking, but what everybody who has any training at all uses French techniques because those are the bases of good cooking.
One last question. Do you ever have disagreements with your doctor about what an appropriate diet for you is?
Absolutely not, because we use the same system of moderation in all things. A great variety of foods and weight watching, exercise, sensible helpings. But I'm a very good advertisement for my own cooking. I'm 77 years old, work a 10-hour day, six, seven, eight days a week, and I'm just in very good form and health.
Well, I'm really glad to hear it, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, good to talk with you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Julia Child has been my guest, and her new book is called The Way to Cook. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with musicologist H.C. Landon Robbins, one of the best-known musicologists in the Western world, the founder of the Haydn Society, and an authority on Mozart. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Drugstore Cowboy is a new film about two couples who rob pharmacies to stay high. Matt Dillon stars as the leader of the crew. Coming up, director Gus Van Sant talks about the obstacles he faced making a film about junkies in the Just Say No era. Also, rock historian Ed Ward shows us that Jerry Lee Lewis wasn't as revolutionary as we all thought. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Slopes of Lebanon, the new collection of essays by Israeli journalist Amos Oz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. West Germany today offered a large amount of financial aid to East Germany if the communist country changes its centralized economy. This comes as the mayor of West Berlin urged his government to meet with East German officials to talk about pressing economic problems created by the sudden opening of East Germany's borders, including currency and traffic problems. East Germany's new prime minister has been holding talks today, getting ready for his announcement of a new government later on this week. Ben Bradshaw reports from Berlin.
In the 1950s, when Hans Modrow was leader of the communist youth movement in East Berlin, he used to dance rock and roll when it was still strictly illegal. He'll need to apply similar energy and innovation to tackle the enormous problems facing East Germany, many of which are only now coming to light. He talks of free elections, multi-party coalitions, and lifting the burden of bureaucracy from the economy. Exactly what he means, though, by his aim of a market-orientated, socialist, planned economy may become clearer when he makes his government statement at the weekend. Meanwhile, the East German authorities say they're thinking about opening the Brandenburg Gate. Its opening would be the most potent symbol yet of the end to the division of this city. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Bradshaw in Berlin.
The government of Czechoslovakia is the latest Eastern Bloc nation to announce that it's easing travel for its citizens. Officials said today that residents of Czechoslovakia will no longer need exit permits to travel outside the country. The State Department and the Pentagon are in disagreement again about the Soviet Union. The State Department sees evidence that the Soviets are cutting their military spending, but the Pentagon says it's too early to tell. Barry Schweid has more on the story.
The Secretaries of State and Defense don't generally agree about the Soviet Union. Secretary of State James Baker tends to see a trend toward reform. Secretary of Defense Richard Cheney is more skeptical. And when it comes to Soviet President Gorbachev's promises to cut back forces, Cheney sees a leaner and meaner Soviet force emerging. This time, the State Department says the Soviets apparently have cut defense spending, including a reduction in conventional weapons. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said troops and conventional arms have been withdrawn from Eastern Europe and from Mongolia. But Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says there's no way of knowing for sure what the Soviets are spending on their military. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Slow car sales helped push overall retail sales down a seasonally adjusted 1% in October after three monthly gains in a row. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 16 points to close at 2,610.25 on volume of some 143 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air.
My name is Jerry Lee Lewis from Louisiana. I'm gonna do your little boogie on this here piano. Doing mighty fine, I'm gonna make it shake it. I'll make it do it and make it do it until you break it. It's called a Lewis boogie, any Lewis way. Lord, I do my little boogie woogie every day.
Jerry Lee Lewis is one of the most famous and infamous piano players in rock and roll. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of some of the musicians who inspired him.
Every now and again, something comes out of nowhere in rock and roll, something that's completely unprecedented and absolutely brand new. More often, however, there's been a long and twisted history behind nearly every innovation. So much has been made of Jerry Lee Lewis and his explosive piano style, not to mention his explosive personality, that I don't think it would do any harm at all to look back at some of the performers who shaped his style. We'll leave the personality to the professionals. Jerry Lee's legend has him and his cousins Mickey Gilley and Jimmy Swaggart creeping around black juke joints in Faraday, Louisiana, to see boogie-woogie piano players and getting inspired by them. That is, of course, true to a large extent, but it's not the whole picture. By the time recording equipment made it to the hills, pianos were far from unusual instruments. That 1927 recording, The Moonshiner's Dance, was made by a semi-professional group of musicians from the rural South, and it's just the earliest country recording I could find with a piano on it. By the late 30s, the height of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys, the piano was an accepted country instrument.
All right, that piano, Mr. Man, yes, sir, I'll.
Post-Warrior, though, is when the piano really ripped loose in country music, and two of its greatest performers appeared.
Old Cherokee chief, as he dances along, he sings an Indian boogie to a white man's song, saying, hey, ho, Lena.
Moon Mullican was known as the king of the hillbilly piano players, and after becoming famous as the piano player with such well-known Texas outfits as Tad Daffin and Floyd Tillman's bands, he went solo after the war and cut a slew of stupendous records.
Oh, would you like to ride in my rocket to the moon?
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
Would you like to ride in my rocket to the moon?
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr. Moon.
Give me your answer and we'll be leaving soon.
Rocket to the moon, rocket, Mr.
Rocket to the Moon, of course, was just a 1952 country version of Jackie Brenston's Rocket 88, which had exploded on the rhythm and blues charts the year before. But it still sounds very surprising to modern ears who think that rock and roll began 2 years later with Elvis. And it wasn't only the boogie-woogie side of Moon Mullican that Jerry Lee heard.
I sail my ship alone with all the dreams I own, drifting out across the ocean blue. I sail my ship alone though all the sails you've torn, and if it starts to sink, then I'll blame you.
The sentimental side of Moon, heard in songs like the heart-rending Sweeter Than the Flowers and I'll Sail My Ship Alone, shows up in Jerry Lee's work, too. Moon Mullican wasn't the only hillbilly piano player around, either. Off in San Diego, there lived a man who's virtually unknown in the United States today.
Lace up your boots and we'll broom on down to a knocked-out shack on the edge of town. An 8-beat combo that just won't quit. Keep a walking till you see a blue light lit. Fall in there and you'll see some sights at the house, the house, the house of blue lights. There's fryers and broilers and Detroit barbecue ribs. But the treat of the treats is when they serve you all those fine 8-beats. You'll want to spend the rest of your rights down at the house, the house, the house of blue lights.
Merrill E. Moore recorded between 1952, when he had his big hit House of Blue Lights, and 1958, at which point he vanished utterly, except in the hearts of various British record collectors. Still, House of Blue Lights was a big enough hit that I think we can assume that Jerry Lee might have heard it too.
Shining down through the trees. Don't the moon look lonesome shining down through the trees? Don't my baby look lonesome when her man ain't around to squeeze?
And on unreleased tracks like Red Light, Moore tries for a marriage of blues and country music very close to what Elvis was trying, albeit more successfully. No, very little of our musical history is without precedent, no matter what it says in the record reviews. Even Jerry Lee Lewis knows that.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll.
Who's gonna play the slow piano after I'm not here? Who's gonna sing these sad songs to you? Cause your eyes to fill the tears. Who's gonna keep these average talking like Jerry's doing now? Who's gonna play the piano after my last bow? When that fine curtain falls.
This is Fresh Air. Drugstore Cowboy is a new film about the hard work of staying high. It follows two couples who rob drugstores and hospital pharmacies to feed their habits. Drugstore Cowboy takes place in Portland, Oregon in 1971. It's based on an unpublished novel written from prison by James Fogel. The film is directed and co-written by my guest Gus Van Sant. It stars Matt Dillon and Kelly Lynch. In this scene, the character played by Matt Dillon tries to get into a methadone treatment program. He becomes frustrated when the counselor asks him questions about his past. When the counselor asks him if he would ever consider helping other addicts kick the habit, he replies,
"To begin with, nobody, and I mean nobody, can talk a junkie out of using. You can talk to them for years, but sooner or later, they're gonna get a hold of something. Maybe it's not dope. Maybe it's booze. Maybe it's glue. Maybe it's gasoline. Maybe it's a gunshot in their head. But something. Something to relieve the pressures of their everyday life, like having to tie their shoes."
Skid Row was also the setting of Gus Van Sant's previous film, Mellanoche. I asked him if he had a literary interest in crime, drugs, and Skid Row.
I think that my stories have been set in these places sort of as a background, and the people that are in the stories are, it's a setting for them, for the characters, in a way maybe that, like, John Ford's setting was Monument Valley, and he placed his characters, his Western characters, in the valley there and, had them relating to between each other and to their setting. I think I use it in that sense, in a lyrical sense.
Mm-hmm. James Fogel, who wrote the novel that the screenplay is based on, is doing time. What is it, a 35-year sentence he's serving?
No, he's been in for 9. I think he has 3 more to go. He has been in and out over the past 35 years since he was 12. He's a sort of career criminal.
Did Fogel give you advice on how to play this story?
No, because he was in prison. So I talked to him once on the phone, and I went to see him once by myself and then again with Matt Dillon. And those were very interesting visits. He mostly, he thought Matt looked like a friend of his who he used to run around with. And he mostly told me and on my visits, he told us stories about his past, sort of tall tales, sort of convict reveries, sort of in their own way. They were funny and also outrageous and maybe true, but then again, you couldn't tell, how embellished his stories were.
Did you find it was hard to interest movie companies in making a film about drugs that wasn't preachy?
There was a problem there because just the climate of the drug, the country's sort of view on drugs and the Just Say No campaigns and so forth, and people's personal sort of relationship to drugs. I think everyone, even if they're the most hardcore junkie, generally would rather stay away from drugs if they can. And so the executives in Hollywood who have the powers to give you millions of dollars to make your movie, you know, really looked at it from a money standpoint. You know, can they make money with this subject? And they interpreted the climate as something that would make people not want to go and make them lose money. And also the history of drug films in the past have been not too, the money hasn't been too good. It's not a genre that they're ready to jump into.
Did anybody give you suggestions on how to make the film more uplifting and therefore more commercial?
There was the company that did the picture, Avenue Pictures, was very concerned that it was a story about a man's redemption and his coming clean and seeing the light, which is in the story, and they were a bit nervous, I think, that we might gloss over that part of the story. But otherwise, there weren't any real direct suggestions other than throw in a lot of rock and roll music. Sometimes people say stuff like that.
I think Matt Dillon gives a terrific performance. Just on a very superficial level, I've always thought of Matt Dillon as being, you know, a very attractive young star. But in this movie, you know, his hair is always unwashed and, you know, kind of greasy. He's wearing plaid pants and a striped V-neck sweater. It's he's certainly not getting by on looks in this.
Yeah, we looked at a lot of pictures, you know, Life magazine spreads of, you know, stories like A Day in the Life of a Junkie, and some other books of photographs of drug addicts. And we noticed a lot of different things about them. You know, one thing about sort of the original people we were looking into, the characters like Fogel and his friends had a particular style. They would dress well, and yet it would be sort of unhip. They would blend very well into a crowd, probably because of their profession of being thieves. And at the same time, I think they sort of liked wearing what they thought were nice clothes. So they were just a little bit out of sync with fashions and so forth, although they were trying very hard. But that was something we really were getting into, the styling of these people. The V-neck sweater and the V-neck T-shirt in particular are something that Matt really latched onto.
Did you go through a period in your life of knowing a lot of junkies yourself?
Not a lot of junkies, but I've known a few. I had some neighbors that went from complete normal sort of non-drug users into the kind of junkies that are in my film over a period of about 2 years. I mean, they went onto this downward spiral. That was incredible. In the end, you know, they lost everything. They lost their house, they lost all their money, and they lost, you know, basically their not their lives, but their livelihood, and locked themselves inside and didn't come out. And I sort of lost touch of them, with them. They moved away, and just all I ever heard were just stories about them sort of haunting the city of Portland. And that was the most immediate example I had of the characters I was making a film about.
What's your next movie going to be? Do you know?
Well, I'm thinking of doing this film called My Own Private Idaho, which is set in Portland. And it's about two street kids that journey from Seattle to Portland and then on to Idaho searching for a lost relative. And it's, again, set on the streets of Portland, and it's about sort of Northwest undesirables.
Have you ever been an undesirable yourself?
Oh, yeah, I probably have been. not a street person, not a street undesirable, but I'm sure I've been. I feel like an outcast in general. I mean, an outsider.
What kind of background are you from?
I'm from an upper middle class background. I grew up in Darien, Connecticut, which is a really WASPy town, And then my family moved to Portland.
Drugstore Cowboy is set in 1971. Do you think that you could have gotten that same tone if you set the movie in 1989, given how the drugs being used and the kinds of crimes committed for drugs have changed?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there are people actually like Bob and Diane and Rick and Nadine who, you know, you can find these characters in Portland today who are sort of the old-time junkies that, you know, they don't do crack because that's addictive. You know, they have these certain, they live a certain way. Drugstores aren't the same as they used to be. I mean, people are much more on the watch in drugstores. They're more, there's higher security in drugstores. The film, we attempted to set it at one time in 1988, and we did face a whole lot of problems. We faced a whole lot of issues that didn't exist in 71, AIDS and crack, and just the whole attitude and the whole feeling of these people living in 1988. To me, it was a real interesting challenge to sort of bring it up to date. But for Matt, he sort of felt insecure about the way the original characters were written and adapting it to today's setting. And so he's the first one to suggest, let's go back to 71. And as we did, I really saw the things that we probably would have just, the film would have been a lot different and probably not half as good, just because we were taking an old story from 71 and we were putting it in another time, 1988, which I think is quite different. And you know, I'm glad that Matt pointed it out and urged us to go back, because I think that's part of the charm of the characters is the period. And in a way, they're 1988 characters set in 71. They're sort of the hardcore drug addicts that we have today, or have more of today, back in the flower power days.
Gus, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay, Terry, thank you.
Gus Van Sant is the director of the new film Drugstore Cowboy. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, is Robert Siegel co-anchoring again from Berlin?
Yes, he is. And Noah Adams is co-anchoring from Boise, Idaho. So we're all over the map today, Terry. From Berlin, Siegel is reporting to us on the difficulties of trying to find a common currency to use in both East and West Germany as the two countries move closer together. We'll also have reports from Mike Schuster, who is in Leipzig. And Noah Adams is traveling on the Great Northern Railway. Today, his trip takes him across North Dakota, and we concentrate on that state and its economy. So East meets West tonight, Jerry.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Amos Oz is one of Israel's best-known and most controversial literary figures. He was born in Jerusalem 50 years ago, lived on a kibbutz for many years, fought in the 1967 and 73 wars, and is a leader of his country's Peace Now movement. Oz has written several novels, including My Michael, The Hill of Evil, and Black Box. He also writes frequently in Israeli newspapers. The Slopes of Lebanon is a new collection of essays by Oz. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Receiving a literary prize in 1983, the Israeli novelist Amos Oz remarked, "Some of us expect literature to provide us with comfort and consolation, or at least a few moments of mercy and grace, or at the very least, a little distance and perspective. But I have neither comfort nor consolation," he went on, "and I have no distance. If I were to speak here and now of everything on my mind, I would spoil the party. If I did not speak, I would be ashamed that I had not spoken." This is what a great writer does when he dissents from his government's policies, when he can't stand what's happening to his country, his century, or the history of his people. He says so out loud, in essays like these, a prophet, and a scourge. Oz could have stuck to his novels and his kibbutz, but the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982, like a timely investment in the stock market, he tells us, like the empire strikes back, enraged him. He's not a pacifist, nor an admirer of the PLO, and he disdains a secular left that would, and I quote, offer peace to the Israeli public as one part of a package deal that includes the rights of nude sunbathers. But he favors a separate Palestinian state. If only good and righteous people with a clean record deserved self-determination, he says, we would have to suspend, starting at midnight tonight, the sovereignty of three-quarters of the nations of the world, beginning with both Germany's and Austria. He reminds us that King Solomon presented 20 of the cities of the land of Israel to King Hiram of Tyre, yet Solomon was not struck down, nor was he condemned by any of the prophets. Besides, says Oz, Hebron and Nablus will not be ours. Whether or not the prophets once walked there, whether or not the stones our ancestors like to throw at the prophets still lie scattered there. What if the Palestinians deceive us? It will always be easier, he says, to break the backbone of a tiny Palestinian state than to break the backbone of an 8-year-old Palestinian stone thrower. In these broadsides, mostly written for the newspaper Davar, Oz has interesting and provocative things to say about the Jew in history, the movie Shoah, a volunteer army, cultural pluralism, and the new Sephardic Jewish middle class. But at desperate issue for him on every page is the soul of Israel and the Zionist ideal of a just society. What have we come here to be, he asks. We have only the power to choose whether or not to be evil ourselves. He is contemptuous. I quote again. What began with the biblical words, Zion shall be redeemed by the law, has come to nobody's better than we are, so they should all shut up. The power in our hands, says Oz, is twisting and corrupting us. He quotes Isaiah, your hands are covered with blood. And he quotes Jeremiah, for they had eyes, but they did not see. Veteran defeatists, both of them, he says, troublers of Israel, self-hating Jews. Not at all, of course. They were righteous citizens, a saving remnant, like Oz, and like Günter Grass in Germany, and Primo Levi in Italy, and Nadine Gordimer in South Africa, and Salman Rushdie in Great Britain. The writer is citizen, the writer is prophet, the writer is sword in the hand of a stricken conscience.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Slopes of Lebanon by Amos Oz. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, musicologist H.C. Robbins Landon debunks some myths about Mozart. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Mozart flute quartets performed on period instruments. And we talk with John Carter about the composition he just premiered at New Music America. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.